Hey, hey. Like rats leaving a sinking ship. Hey. Well, good evening, everyone. My name's Jack, and I am an alcoholic. I come to you from Hagerstown, Maryland, where I am a member of the cleverly named Hagerstown Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Our group is the third oldest group in the state of Maryland, and when our group was organized, you had one town, you had one group. And then a couple of resentments and a few coffee pots, and the next thing you know, we got 15 groups and 50-some meetings, and that's how we grow in Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to thank the committee for allowing Jerry to invite me to be here this evening. I think it's important that you know who is responsible for my being here. Jerry's right over here. And he's responsible for my being here. Because if I say anything that offends you during the next 3 hours that we're together, then I want you to take that up with Jerry, because he's the one who's responsible for my being here, and don't talk to me about it. But if I happen to say something that you agree with, then by all means, please say something to me after the meeting, because I really do like those attaboys. So you know, alcoholics, at least my kind of alcoholic, I do not like being told what to do. I really don't. And my history is that when I am told to do something, I generally do the opposite. And I listened to Mary Pearl this afternoon, and apparently Al-Anons are like that also. So if you're here tonight and you're Al-Anon like Mary Pearl, or alcoholic like I am, and you have a cell phone with you, by all means, turn it on. Especially if you're expecting a liver transplant. Now, I would ask that you put it on vibrate, and that way you can enjoy your incoming call and you won't disturb the rest of us. My mother is 93 years old and lives in her home in Hagerstown. I called her this afternoon to remind her where I was, and she said, "Are you talking to another one of those AA things?" I said, "Yes, ma'am, I sure am." She says, "Will you make sure you tell those people that you are not an alcoholic?" My mom was married to my alcoholic father for 30 years, and she knows what an alcoholic is. And she says, "I'm not an alcoholic." I may have ever reacted to this whole thing. I don't know. So, I know you all know this, but just in case somebody gets hold of one of these recordings of Charles, I am not a spokesperson for Alcoholics Anonymous, and nor am I an authority or an expert on Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been asked to come here to share my experience, strength, and hope, and I will try to do that. However, sometimes I throw in a little bit of my opinion, strength, and hope, and I'll try to keep that out as best I can. And our book says, and I'm to tell you in a general way, what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And I'm going to try to do that. Before I do that, however, I want to thank Dennis for the lead that he gave last night. If you weren't here last night, you missed a wonderful, wonderful alcoholic talk. And so you're going to want to get that CD. And then this afternoon, Mary Pearl proved beyond a reasonable doubt to a moral certainty that you do not have to drink to be crazy. I I started drinking when I was 14 or 15 years of age. I'm really not sure how old I was, but I certainly remember the effect that alcohol had. And my guess is that it had the same effect on me as it did on you if you're alcoholic and you're here tonight, and that is it answered all of my questions. It allowed me to fit in where I never fit in before. It allowed me to do things I could never do before. It allowed me to be a part of instead of apart from. You know, I felt as if I got taller, straighter, handsomer, felt like my pimples fell off. I heard a lady one night say her boobs got big. Well, I didn't have the boob experience, but I had the pimple experience. And I knew why my father drank. I knew why he drank. It was a shame he couldn't control his drinking like I could, but I knew why he drank. I used to say that I really didn't have any problems drinking when I was in high school, but now as a result of good sponsorship, I know that I spent 5 years in high school, and I used to think it was a series of bad breaks and misunderstandings, but I now understand it was the alcohol. But I want you to know that when I got out of high school, I went to the community college, and one summer at the community college, my good friend Bill and I decided we were going to take a road trip. We're going to drive to California, so we got 12 cases of beer. I put them in the back of my car. We each packed an overnight bag. We had everything you needed to drive to California. We didn't have a map, but we knew we'd find it. But on the night before we were to leave, Bill's dad wouldn't let him go. And I was crushed. And now Bill's a stand-up guy, and he did give me his interest in those 12 cases of beer. I had quit my job, and I had a pocket full of money, and as many of you may know, there's a little piece of the eastern part of Maryland that borders the Atlantic Ocean, and we have a resort community there called Ocean City. So I went down to Ocean City, where I lived for a month as a bum. I didn't have a job. I lived in the basement of hotels where friends of mine worked. I ate leftover restaurant food from restaurants where friends of mine were waiters and waitresses, and I didn't have to pay anything for room, and I didn't have to pay anything for board, and I had 12 cases of beer to drink, and then when I ran out of beer, I had a pocket full of money to buy more to drink, and I had a great month in Ocean City, and I had so much fun in Ocean City that I decided that I wanted to work in Ocean City. But I'm a keen observer of my surroundings, and it was apparent to me that if you drank like I drank and acted like I acted over the course of a summer, it didn't make any difference whether you were a lifeguard or a beach boy or a bellhop or a waiter or a waitress. If you drank like I drank and acted like I acted over the course of a summer, you could very well get arrested. And I did not want to get arrested. But I did notice that there were a group of people working in Ocean City who drank like I drank and acted like I acted, and they were not getting arrested. And these were the members of the Ocean City Police Department. So I became a police officer. I was assigned a boardwalk beat, and within a matter of a few days, it became apparent that I possess a singularly unique talent that comes in very handy as a police officer. Working in a resort community, I could spot an underage drinker from 100 yards. And I would pick out my target of opportunity. I would approach them. I would establish that indeed they were under the lawful age to drink. I would ask what they had in the cooler. They would say some Coca-Cola. A little tuna fish, some bread. Well, let's open the cooler. Okay. Open the cooler. There's the Coca-Cola, a nice even row in the crushed ice. Little Tupperware thing of tuna fish, loaf of bread. I'd reach way down the bottom of that cooler. And invariably, I'd come up with a Budweiser. Now, if you were that underage drinker, your life, as you've known it, has just ended. because you are going to jail. Yes, I understand that you thought you were going to be going to college, but you're not. You're going to jail. You may have thought a military career was in your future, but the military doesn't want jailbirds like you. As a matter of fact, I'm going to call your mom and dad back in Baltimore at 3 a.m. this morning, and I'm going to explain to them that you have been arrested and are in the Ocean City Jail, and they have to come down to bond you out. You wanted to offer an alternative. What did you have in mind? Confiscate the beer. Well, that certainly merits discussion, but you do understand if I confiscate the beer, I'm going to have to take the cooler. And if I take the cooler, I'm going to have to take the tuna fish and the Coca-Cola. You're okay with that. All right. Well, you're going to have to promise me, you're going to have to give me your word that you are never, ever going to do this again in Ocean City. You promise? Okay, you're free to go. Now, it's really hard to walk a beat when you're dragging a cooler full of beer around behind you. So I had to work out a deal with my lieutenant and my sergeant, and they would come and collect the coolers as I got them, and then we'd meet at the end of my shift, and if I'd gotten any wine or whiskey, I'd give them the wine and the whiskey, and I'd take the cooler and the beer and the tuna fish and the Coca-Cola. I had a great summer that summer. I drank every day. I didn't buy anything to drink the entire summer that I was there, and I did not get arrested, and that's my definition of a good summer. So I went back for a second year. They gave me a squad car. Yeah, lights and sirens. And I expanded my territory. It was one of those big old Ford Crown Victorias. Big old trunk. You'd get three bodies or five coolers in one of those things. And I really didn't need my lieutenant and sergeant like I did the previous year, but they maintained a interest in my activities, and I would meet them at the end of the shift, and I'd give them the whiskey and the wine, and I would take the coolers and go home. And if you were an acquaintance of mine, or even if you weren't an acquaintance of mine, if you were a friend of mine, and you came to Ocean City and you needed a cooler, I'm your guy. I got coolers stacked up to the ceiling of my back porch, and I have a no-return policy. So you just pick the one out you want. Had a good summer that summer. I drank every day. Didn't buy anything to drink the entire summer, and I did not get arrested. So I went back for a third summer. Now, what I'm about to tell you was an event that changed the course of my life. It was 3 o'clock in the morning. I was on the beach highway. I had stopped a car for drunk driving. Had the guy out of the car. He was obviously drunk. I was writing him up. He said to me, "You don't know who I am, do you, officer?" I said, "No, sir, I don't." He said, "Well, I am the state's attorney for Worcester County, the county you're standing in right now. I'm a college kid. I have no idea what a state's attorney is. I've never heard the term before. I don't know what they do." So I said, "Well, good for you. Sign the ticket." He signed the ticket. There was a fella in the car who did not appear to be drunk, and I let him drive. I went about my business. At the end of the shift, I pulled into the parking lot of the Ocean City Police Department, and there in the parking lot was the chief of police. And he said, "Come up to my office and bring that uniform citation book with you." Now, these were the first words that the chief had spoken to me during the entire summer. I thought this was a good thing. I thought I was about to get recognition for a job well done. Long overdue recognition, I might add. And so I went up to his office, and much to my surprise, as I walked into his office, seated on the couch right inside the door was the guy I gave the ticket to at 3 o'clock in the morning. Chief said, "Give me that ticket book." I gave him the ticket book. He handed it to the guy on the couch. Guy on the couch opened it up to the ticket, took out a pencil or a pen, and wrote across the face of that ticket, "Case dismissed," and signed his name. Well, it was at that moment I decided I wanted to be a lawyer. And if I could become one of those state's attorneys, I definitely wanted to be one of them. Because if you drank and drove like I drank and drove, the ability to dismiss traffic tickets with a stroke of a pen was going to come in mighty handy. So I went to law school. Clint, I'm going to put my watch up here. Not because I can really see it or pay much attention to it, but I just think it gives hope to the newcomer. So I got out of law school, and my wife and I moved back to Hagerstown, where I'd grown up. And I'd been practicing law maybe 8-10 weeks, and I became aware of a vacancy in the state's attorney's office. So I went right over. Here I am, answer to your prayers, when would you like me to start? Now, what I'm about to tell you is what I thought I heard them say. Turns out I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous many of the things that I thought were said in my life had never been said, I just thought they were said. Many things I thought I saw happen in my life never happened, I just thought I saw them happen. I have a problem with perception, I have a problem with hearing. So here's what I think I heard them say. What? Are you some kind of an idiot? You just got out of law school. You've never been in a courtroom. You've never tried a case. You've never impaneled a jury. You've never examined or cross-examined a witness. We don't have any time to train you. Get out of the office. That's what I thought I heard them say. In truth, they said something to the effect that the position has already been filled. But I heard what I heard, and I was hurt, wounded, angry. And as a result of good sponsorship, I now know I left there with a resentment. And an alcoholic with a resentment can do quite a bit. Now, in our community, we elect our prosecutors. So I went out and found a lawyer who wanted to be state's attorney. I ran his campaign for state's attorney. He got elected state's attorney, and he made me deputy state's attorney. Now, when you get to be deputy state's attorney, they give you a badge. And with that badge, they give you a badge case. That badge case has a clear glassine window behind which you put your driver's license. And when they pull you over and they come up to the car and they say license and registration, and you open up that badge case, they don't ask what that... They don't ask about your driver's license. They say, what kind of badge is that? Deputy State's Attorney, Washington County. No, sir, officer, I am not upset that you stopped me. No, sir, I understand you're just doing your job. I may have had two or three. Yes, sir. I only have a couple more miles to go. Yeah, I think I can stay on my side of the road. Well, I really appreciate the professional courtesy. Thank you so much. And you have a nice night too, officer. Now, some of you may be getting a little insight into why I've never been arrested. But it gets better. My boss, the state's attorney, was going to be appointed circuit court judge. And if he got appointed circuit court judge, I'm going to get appointed state's attorney. I don't know how it is here in Georgia, but sometimes back in Maryland, the local state senator sticks his nose in where it doesn't belong and screws the whole thing up. And that's what happened in this case. And somebody else got appointed circuit court judge. And I felt sorry for my friend. But I was really upset that I didn't get to be state's attorney. That may not be much, but I'm all I think about. So one night, while having some adult beverages with some like-minded individuals, it was determined that something ought to be done about that state senator. He shouldn't be allowed to get away with this. Somebody ought to run against him. So I ran for the state senate. Now, I did not know that the state senator was going to run off with a secretary from the Appropriations Committee, abandon his wife and children, and move to Florida. But he did, and I got elected state senator. Now, in Maryland, when you get elected state senator, they give you a license plate, and it says state senator. Now, this is an aid to efficient law enforcement. Because when they come up behind you on the interstate, and they got those overheads going, and they get close enough to see that license plate, they turn those overheads off. They come out around beside of you, they turn that interior dome light on, and they toot. Beep, beep. Hi, Senator. Hi, Trooper. Hold it down, Senator. Okay, Trooper. And that way, you don't have members of the state police alongside of the highway with members of the General Assembly when they could be out arresting real crooks. Now, that guy that got appointed circuit court judge, he didn't like the job, so he quit. I went over to see the governor. I want my guy to be appointed circuit court judge. Governor said, we're really sorry. There was just too much negative publicity associated with that last appointment up there in Hagerstown. However, if you'd like to be circuit court judge, I'll appoint you. Well, it's a 15-year term, and we only had two in our community, so, I became circuit court judge. I know, it's a little scary. As a member of the circuit court, I tried to be helpful to the Bar Association in any way I could. An example of my being helpful, they were going to have a continuing legal education program on the prosecution and defense of drunk driving. And they were going to have Sergeant Long there with his breathalyzer. And they needed a volunteer to drink the beer. Somebody who was fair-minded, unbiased, a neutral party, if you would. So I said I'd help out. And they brought out this tray, had six beers all iced down, and I said, what's that? And the guy said, that's the beer for tonight's program. I said, you only brought out six beers. This is a two-hour program. He said, oh, we have more beer in the back. I said, well, you better ice it down and bring it out because I'm not drinking any warm beer. So he did, and you know, they commenced the program, and I commenced to drink, and then every 15 minutes, I blow into the breathalyzer. And, you know, you jump off at a .05 and kick it up to a .13 and .19, .23, .28, .33. And right after I blew that .33, they called upon me to put on my part of the program, which I'm told was quite good under the circumstances. After the program was over, I asked the guy who had invited me, the chairman, I said, who's going to take me home? He said, what do you mean? I said, I just blew a .33 in Sergeant Long's breathalyzer. I can't go out and get in my car and drive home. He said, well, we didn't think about that. I said, well, tell you what, I'll go in the hotel bar here, and I'll have a couple drinks. And when Sergeant Long's gone, you just come on in and get me. So I did. I went in, had three or four drinks, and then they came in and said he'd left, so I went down to the Broad Axe, which was my favorite watering hole, and had three or four down there, and then I went over to the Broad Axe and had two or three over there, and or not the Broad Axe, over the cellar door, and had two or three there, and then I went home. And that was a night of social drinking for the judge. And I loved drinking. Loved everything about drinking. I love the ambiance of drinking. I love the neon lights. I like the way the light plays off the bottles in the back bar mirror. I like the sawdust on the floor and the peanut shells. I like the smell of urine and stale beer. I loved it all. I love top shelf. I love bottom shelf. I love imported. I love domestic. I prefer a twist-off cap, but if all you have has got a cork in it, I'm willing to work with that. I like the glassware of drinking. I like the tall, slim, frosted Tom Collins glasses. I like the little short squat old-fashioned glasses. I like the shot glasses, single and double shots. I like the stemware of the gin martini. One time I had a love affair with a gin martini. Where can you get olives like that except a gin martini? Although I have to acknowledge I had a very bad gin experience, and even to this day it's hard for me to go into a pine forest. My drink of choice was Jack Daniel's Black Label on crushed ice with a twist of lemon. Now that was a drink. That was to die for. That was my very favorite. On April the 7th, 1982, a lawyer in Hagerstown and I had determined that we were going to go out and get drunk. This was not one of those occasions when I negligently allowed myself to be overserved. This was one of those occasions when the intended purpose was to get drunk. Knee-walking, snot-flying drunk. And we did. And we ended up in a local watering hole. And if I'd had any idea whatsoever that I was about to take my last drink of beverage alcohol, I can assure you I would have ordered something different. If I had any idea whatsoever that I was going to come to Carterville, Georgia, and talk to you fine people about my last drink of beverage alcohol, you can be assured I would have ordered something else. Because there is a lot of embarrassment and a lot of shame behind what I'm about to tell you. My last drink of beverage alcohol was Tia Maria. How do you think I feel? I mean, there are people in here tonight who have no idea what Tia Maria is. And if you're one of those people, you don't really need to know what Tia Maria is. My wife's a school teacher, elementary school. I suspect that your elementary school children here in Georgia are very much like ours back home in Maryland. Those little elementary school kids are just covered with germs. And the germs get on the teachers, and the teachers bring those germs home, and the spouse gets sick. And I got up the next morning, I had flu. Pesky little kids had done it to me again. But I went to work, because we go to work if we can get there. Next day was Good Friday, so I did not have to go to work. You know, Good Friday, courthouse was closed. I developed that upset stomach that frequently goes with flu. And by Saturday, I'd had to develop that lower tract of stress that frequently accompanies flu. And if you've got that lower tract of stress thing going on with that upset stomach thing, that'll hone your decision-making down to a very fine edge, because I didn't know whether to sit or kneel or kneel or sit. And I made the wrong decision on at least one occasion that weekend. And if my wife was here, you could talk to her about that. But felt a little better on Easter Sunday, but by Easter Monday, I was very dehydrated from all that kneeling and sitting that I'd been doing over the weekend. And they put me in the hospital, and that night my abdomen became distended, and they performed an emergency laparotomy on me, opened up my abdomen, and they found it was full of gangrene, peritonitis. And while they were trying to clean that up, my kidneys quit. My liver was enlarged and out of whack. My pancreas was digesting itself. And my respiratory system quit. Things were not looking good for the home team. And they got me off the respirator in short order. But for the following 3 weeks, I was in intensive care. And my physical condition continued to deteriorate. And finally, they told my wife they were going to send me down to Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore, and if there was anything that could be done for me at all, they would be able to do it. But they had exhausted all of their alternatives in Hagerstown, and They also told her not to expect me to be coming back because they didn't think there was anything could be done for me and they expected me to die there. I'm glad they didn't tell me that because I'd have been discouraged by that. But so I went down to Johns Hopkins and for 2 weeks they did everything but hang me by my thumbs. And my belly button birthday is May the 14th. And on May the 13th, the physicians who were handling my case came to our room. And before they could really get anything out of their mouths, I just said, you know, I just can't take it anymore. I mean, this is excruciating. You got to give me a day of rest. And they said, well, Judge, that's why we're here tonight. We've done everything we know to do. We've presented your case to the internal medicine department. We have not been able to get a majority vote on what's wrong with you. So, yes, tomorrow we're going to give you a day of rest. And so I turned 40 in the Johns Hopkins Hospital. 2 weeks later, on May the 28th, I was discharged from Johns Hopkins Hospital. My kidney function returned. My liver went back to within normal limits. My pancreas stopped digesting itself. And when you've been in the hospital for 7 weeks like that, they like to have a little meeting with you, talk to you about the do's and don'ts. And but if you got an undiagnosed illness, they don't know what to talk to you about. In my case, they said, Judge, we just suggest you not get it again, whatever it was, because it's likely to kill you. And, you know, I believed then that it's better to survive an undiagnosed illness than to die of a known cause. And I believe that then. I believe it now. And I was just about ready to walk out of that doctor's office, and they said, could we ask you one more question? I said, sure, doc. He said, do you drink? Well, I mean, I'm a lawyer. Well, I'm a judge now, but I used to be a lawyer. When I was a lawyer, I drank with clients. I had to drink with other lawyers. I had to drink with judges. Now that I'm a judge, I have to drink with lawyers, and I got to drink with other judges. It's kind of a professional obligation. How much do you drink? Not much. Why do you ask? Well, we just think it would be good for you to not drink for a while. How long? A year. A year? Why? Well, your kidneys are working now, and there's nothing that destroys kidneys like alcohol. And then your liver was all out of whack, and we don't know what's going to happen if you ingest alcohol. What will happen to your liver? We don't know if there's any permanent damage or not. And your pancreas has stopped digesting itself, and nothing destroys the pancreas like alcohol. And you've got all three of these very sensitive organs involved, and we just think you should not drink for a while. How long? A year. Huh. A year. Well, I haven't had a drink since April the 7th. This is May 28th. I think I can do that. They said, no, Judge, you don't understand. This is Labor Day weekend. Not Labor, Memorial Day weekend. We want you to not drink for 1 year from June the 1st. Now, I think there are people in this room tonight who can already discern the injustice that these doctors were trying to foist upon me. Because I was not getting credit for my 7 weeks of continuous sobriety. I want you to know that an argument broke out between these two learned physicians and this knuckleheaded judge. And we reached a compromise. And the compromise was that I would not drink until next April the 7th. And then if I thought any of the pain, suffering, and misery which I had just endured had anything at all to do with drinking, then I could choose not to drink until next June the 1st. And I walked out of those offices into the most insane period of my life. Not drinking and not changing. Not drinking and not changing. You know, in our big book it says, when alcohol is removed from the alcoholic tends to become restless, irritable, and discontented. That was a gross understatement in my case. I was more pissed off in the spring-loaded position is what I was. It's kind of like don't drink and go to meetings. I sure hope you folks here in Georgia do not tell newcomers to your groups, just don't drink and go to meetings. Because we kill alcoholics when we tell them that. Tell them don't drink. Go to meetings. Get a sponsor. Get a big book. Take the steps. Now that saves lives. But our book says in unequivocal terms that if you remove alcohol from the alcoholic will drink again. Slow suicide. And our experience confirms that if the alcoholic doesn't drink again, then he or she will shoot themselves, drive into a bridge abutment, hang themselves, go out a window. Fast suicide. Those are the only alternatives for the alcoholic. Those are the only alternatives. Unless the alcoholic learns to live on a spiritual basis. Well, I'm not drinking and I'm not changing and I am crazy. I mean crazy. I've got two friends, Ken and Bob, who are active members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they're watching me die of untreated alcoholism. Now, my dad, my alcoholic father, who was married to my mom for 30 years before they divorced, on July the 3rd, 1968, walking by a Methodist church, he read the message board out front. The pastor had put this message on the board. Don't buy a fifth on the third for the fourth. My dad went to AA that night, and he never drank again. And when he died with 15 years of continuous sobriety in this wonderful program. And I owe a tremendous debt of gratitude for Alcoholics Anonymous for my father's life. Because he lost everything of value that he owned drinking, and he lost that priceless stuff that you can't buy. And then he got back the priceless stuff. He got back his integrity. He got back his self-esteem. He got back his relationship with his daughter and with his son. And he was an active, productive member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And Ken and Bob knew that, and they came to me and they said, you know, your dad, he died with 15 years of sobriety. We got this book in AA. It's called The Big Book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And we thought maybe you might be interested in reading it to find out about your dad's illness. Clever guy, that Bob. See, there's nothing wrong with me. See, with every passing day of every passing week of every passing month of every passing year that I don't drink, that's proof positive that I'm not alcoholic because, you see, we all know alcoholics drink, and I'm not drinking, therefore not alcoholic, okay? All right, now maybe I'm a little on edge, okay? Maybe I'm a little prickly, all right? But you know, if you just mind your own business, leave me the heck alone, if you just tend to your own knitting and not be messing in my business, you know, things would be a lot better around here because I'm fine. You hear me? I am fine. How'd you like to have your DWI in front of me, Clint, Monday morning, huh? I'm fine. So I read that book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and my dad's in there. My dad was a real alcoholic, as defined by the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was not surprised to find him in there. However, what I had not counted upon and what Ken and Bob had counted upon was I found me in there. I didn't understand how a book that was written before I was born would have so much of my life in it. I was really stunned. And I went to Ken and Bob and I told them that having read the book, I was willing to concede that there was a possibility, a remote possibility, but a possibility nonetheless, that I may have very well contracted a very mild case of alcoholism. We caught it just in time. But that's all Ken and Bob needed. And they started coming to my chambers every Friday at noon. That is my judge's office. And they would bring a brown bag lunch and their big books. And I had my big book. And we'd have lunch and we'd pray the Serenity Prayer. And we'd read the big book. And then they would discuss with me the importance of what we'd read. And then I would discuss with them as Jack sees it. And as you might expect, we had many high-level intellectual discussions about the content of that book and the meaning of the words in it. And I pointed out to Ken and Bob, as I'm about to point out to you, because I think it's important that you know this, that while it is true that I spent 5 years in high school, I graduated from community college in 2 years with an associate's degree. I graduated University of Maryland College Park with a bachelor's degree in 2 more years. And 3 years after that, I graduated from University of Maryland School of Law with a Juris Doctorate degree, with honors, I might add. And Ken said, you know, Jack, they have degrees on rectal thermometers, and you know what we do with them. I had not heard that before coming to AA. I thought it was a little harsh. They were in my office. Ken and Bob knew I was dying of untreated alcoholism, and they knew if something didn't happen, it didn't happen soon, I was indeed going to die. You see, they were willing to risk offending me because I'd been offended before, and they knew I'd get over being offended. And they were willing to risk angering me because they knew I'd been angry before, and I would get over it. But they knew that if something didn't change, I was very definitely going to die of untreated alcoholism. Now, the sheriff in our community had shot himself to death in the basement of our courthouse. And my office, my chambers, were on the top floor of the courthouse. And I had decided that if I shot myself to death in my office on the top floor, that would add symmetry to the building. Think that's funny? I mean, that is sick. That's giving you an idea of the quality of my thinking. See, Ken and Bob knew something I didn't know. And they knew, if I knew, that they knew something I didn't know, that the fact that I knew that they knew something I didn't know would anger me. Yet they also knew that unless I found out what it was that they knew that I didn't know, that I didn't know what it was that they knew that I didn't know, if I didn't find out what it was that they knew that I didn't know, that I was going to die of untreated alcoholism. So they just continued to persistently and consistently deliver the program of Alcoholics Anonymous to me because they knew there would come a time, by God's grace, that I would know what it was that they knew that I didn't know. And at that point, knowing what they knew that I didn't know would no longer anger me because I would then know what it was that they knew that I didn't know. Because in AA, you know what you know when you know and not a moment before. Now, if you followed any of that, you're in the right place. And if you found that to be the least bit confusing, you're still in the right place. It just means you don't know. Well, it's December 22nd, 1989. The courthouse was closed for Christmas holiday. We could not have our big book study because the courthouse was closed. So Ken and Bob and I went out to have lunch. And then after lunch, we went our separate ways. And When I was drinking, my wife and I were separated on 3 separate occasions. And there were women involved. And after I stopped drinking, my wife and I were separated on 3 separate occasions, and there were women involved. Now, I think that's pretty conclusive evidence that drinking had nothing to do with any of those 6 separations. But alcoholism had everything to do with all six of those separations, and we had no idea. None whatsoever. Now, if I don't screw this thing up, next Wednesday, my wife and I'll be married 42 years. And if she were here, you'd probably want to give her a chip for that. She's been married all 42 of those years. I've had some time off for bad behavior, as I just told you. We were separated, and I went back to my apartment. And propped against my apartment door was a Hickory Farms package, one of those things that you see at Christmas time. Somebody had sent a... Good luck with that liver transplant. I tell you, I am easily distracted. And then I forget where I am. My name's Jack, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm from Hagerstown, Maryland, and I'm a member of the Hickory Farms. Somebody had sent the judge a cheese log or a sausage. I thought that was very nice. Took that package into my office. I got messages on my answering machine to play. I've got plans. I got plans for that night, Friday night. I got plans for Saturday. I got plans for Christmas Eve. I got plans for Christmas Day. I got plans for New Year's. I got plans for well into the next year. And I see where this box has been sealed by tape, and I cut it with my car keys, and I'm taking the messages off my answering machine, and I lift the lid of that box, and boom! And I got blown back against the wall. Now, about 10 days before that, a judge in Birmingham, Alabama, had been killed by an explosive device, had been sent to his home. 5 days before, a lawyer here in Georgia, in Savannah, had been killed by a bomb that had been sent to his office. And I could smell the gunpowder, and I knew it opened a bomb. And there was a fire, and I tried to put it out, and I couldn't. I went out in the hallway and pulled a fire alarm for the building. My neighbor came, said he had a fire extinguisher. I went back into the apartment and went to call 911, and when I went to press the buttons on the phone, I discovered that part of my right hand had been blown away. And after I hung up the phone from that call, I felt like somebody was trying to pull my trousers off my hips. And I looked down at the ground, and I was standing in a puddle of blood, and it was just getting bigger and bigger and bigger as I watched it. And I knew I was in serious trouble. My neighbor came and asked if there was anything else he could do, and I asked him to get me a towel. And he gave me a towel, and I opened my trousers. I did not have the courage to attempt to visualize the wound. I just put the towel where I thought I'd been injured. And I put my back against the wall, and I slid down onto the floor. And I was alone. And I was scared. And I was powerless. And I didn't know what to do. And the only tool that I had learned through those big book lunches. My name's Jack. The only tool I had learned in those lunches, study that big book, and that was the Serenity Prayer. And I began to pray the Serenity Prayer and pray the Serenity Prayer and pray the Serenity Prayer and to ask God to grant me the serenity to accept this thing which I could not change. And to give me the courage to change what I could and the wisdom to know the difference. And I can't tell you whether it was the fifth, sixth, seventh, or eighth time through that prayer, but I can tell you that it was answered. And God came. And I was overcome by a sense of peace and well-being, the likes of which I have never experienced before in my life, nor have I ever experienced it since. I had no idea whether I was going to live or die on that floor. I just knew that if I died on that floor and never saw my wife and our three children again, it'd be okay. I'd be all right. Well, the police, fire, and rescue people burst through the door of my apartment. Both of my eardrums had been blown out, and I really had a lot of difficulty hearing what they were saying. And as soon as I tried to communicate with them, a tremendous wave of fear swept upon me. And so I told them, I said, "You guys just do whatever you have to do." And I went back to the Serenity Prayer. And as soon as I did, that sense of peace and well-being returned. And they cut all my clothes off of me, and except for my red and green Christmas socks. And they strapped me on a board and put me on a gurney and carried me down three flights of steps and stuffed me in an ambulance. And our local TV station was Johnny on the Spot, and got a picture of my red and green Christmas socks sticking out the back of that ambulance. And those Christmas socks went around the world on CNN, and I went off to the hospital for surgery. And they couldn't find my wife, and they couldn't find my girlfriend, but they did find my sponsor, Ken. And they let him come back to where I was being prepared for surgery. And he prayed for me. And we prayed together. And they took me up to surgery. And I don't know how shrapnel knows to stop passing through flesh, but I can only tell you what they told me. They removed a rather significant piece of shrapnel, not resting against, but in close proximity to my femoral artery. And had my femoral artery been nicked, you'd have a different speaker here this evening. And they took me up to a recovery room, and when I came to, at the foot of my bed was my sponsor, Bob. Now let me say here that it's good to have a sponsor. Sponsors see things differently. If you're here tonight and you don't have a sponsor, there are any number of people in this room who are eminently qualified to be your sponsor. For God's sake, don't wait for someone you can relate to. I mean, you're crazy, for God's sake. Why would you want to have a crazy person for a sponsor? If you're not new here, maybe you're used here, and maybe you and your sponsor have grown apart, or maybe your sponsor's moved away or passed on, and maybe you're doing that I sponsor myself thing here of Alcoholics Anonymous, the ism of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're here tonight and you're sponsoring yourself, I don't mean to be cruel or unkind. You have an idiot for a sponsor. It's good to have a sponsor. I looked at Bob, and Bob was smiling. I said, "Bob, I see you're smiling. What are you smiling at?" He said, "Oh, Jack," he said, "I think it must be wonderful to know that you can't be harmed." I said, "Bob, somebody just tried to kill me." He said, "I know." He said, "I understand that package that you opened contained four pipe bombs. One pipe bomb is more than adequate to kill a human being. Two pipe bombs is a little redundant. Three pipe bombs is around the bend. Four pipe bombs, Jack, you have made somebody very angry." "Man has done his very best to kill you, Jack, and the only explanation of your survival is the grace of God." Good to have a sponsor. I wouldn't have come up with that in a million years. He said, "Jack, God has saved you for a purpose. He has work for you." I said, "Really, Bob? What kind of work does God have for me?" He said, "Oh, I don't know, Jack." He said, "I wouldn't presume to know God's will for you in that area." He says, "But here's something I do know. I know it's God's will for you to be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that means you're going to have to pray that third step prayer with either Ken or with I. You're going to have to do that four-step inventory. Do that fifth step with me or with Ken. Make that six-step decision. Pray that seven-step prayer. Make that eight-step list. Begin making those nine-step amends so you can live in 10, 11, and 12 and be of maximum service to God and to your fellow man." Good to have a sponsor. I wouldn't come up with that either. Well, I got out of the hospital on Christmas Day, best Christmas I ever had up to that point. Following Christmas, 1990, my wife and I reconciled, and we've been together uninterruptedly ever since. And I think I can say without fear of contradiction that our lives together as man and wife are better today than they've ever been in the history of our relationship. And our big book says the power of God goes deep. And my experience confirms that. Broken hearts can be mended here. Relationships can be restored. But I had to get out of the debating society. I'm a really smart guy. And being smart damn near killed me. So I had to dummy up a little bit. You know, in our big book, it says that the problem for the alcoholic is not drinking. Alcohol is merely a symptom of my problem. My problem is thinking. I am not good at it. Simply how I think is my problem. S-H-I-T. Simply how I think is my problem. The big book says that. My experience confirms it. Now, we've got this pamphlet here in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's called Is AA for You? And these pamphlets are always being revised, and I have proposed a revision to headquarters. I'd like you to hear part of it, see what you think. Have you ever decided to stop thinking for a week or so, but only lasted for a couple of days? Do you wish people would mind their own business about your thinking and stop telling you what to do? Do you envy people who could think without getting into trouble? Have you had problems connected with thinking during the past year? Has your thinking caused trouble at home? Do you tell yourself that you can stop thinking anytime you want to, even though you keep thinking when you don't mean to? Have you missed days of work or school because of your thinking? Have you ever felt that your life would be better if you did not think? I think that's pretty conclusive evidence that thinking is my problem, not drinking. When Bob and Ken were coming to my office and we were reading the big book, I like to describe that as being cake mix recovery. And by that I mean if we were to go out to a grocery store tonight and get a box of Duncan Hines red velvet cake mix and brought it back here to this meeting hall, I can assure you, you can trust me on this, Duncan Hines has put on the back of that box a 3-step program for the production of a red velvet cake. And I'm the kind of guy, we can give that box to Clint, and he could read it to us all, or we can hand it down to you all and pass it one person to the next, and we could read the steps out loud to each other. But I'm the kind of guy, having read the back of that box, I'm looking for my red velvet cake. Where's my cake? You see, I haven't done anything. I haven't even opened a box, let alone break an egg. I'm reading the box. I'm looking for my cake. Friday after Friday after Friday, month after month after month, Ken and Bob and I met in my office, and we read the big book. And we discussed it. And I looked around for recovery. Hadn't done anything. Just read the book. Looking for recovery. Having broken an egg, looking for my cake. I can't get red velvet cake unless I get into action. I can't get recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous unless I get into action. I can only live on fear and fellowship for so long. The program of recovery of Alcoholics Anonymous is contained in the 12 steps. Not step 1 and step 13, but the 12 steps. And to recover from alcoholism, from a seemingly hopeless condition of mind and body, it is necessary for me to take all 12 of those steps and inculcate them into my life as a design for living. I get to do a lot of things in my life. People ask me, where do you fit? How can you fit? How do you find the time to fit AA into your busy life? And I don't. See, Alcoholics Anonymous has become my life. And because of this new way of life that I have been given, I am privileged to do the many things that I get to do in my life. Absent Alcoholics Anonymous, I wouldn't have a life. We get to live two lives in the same lifetime. Not very many people get to do that. You know, if you're here tonight and you're alcoholic like I'm alcoholic, it's important that we all understand that most alcoholics never get to these rooms. Most alcoholics die never even hearing of Alcoholics Anonymous. Hard to believe, but true. Out there, we die. In here, we get to live. Tomorrow in this community, a lot of folks are going to gather up in buildings all over this town. And they're going to be wondering whether or not God exists. And you and I get to watch God work every day. Every day. There isn't any question in my mind about the existence of God. Good orderly direction, group of drunks, spirit of the universe, doesn't matter. Power greater than myself. That has done for me what I could not do for myself, has rendered me happily and usefully whole, and has given me a way of life that allows me to live happy, joyous, and free. And if you're here tonight and you're not happy, joyous, and free, then please get with your sponsor and talk with him or her about what it is that you're doing that you shouldn't be doing, or what it is that you're not doing that you should be doing. Because our book doesn't say happy, joyous, and free is for like one or two of us here and there now and then. Our book says that every single solitary one of us are guaranteed happy, joyous, and free if we'll suit up and show up and do the deal. And it says in our book it's easy to let up on the program of recovery. It's easy. And the reason they put that in the book is because it's easy to let up on a program of recovery. My mind is trying to kill me. Would have done so a long time ago if it didn't need my body for transportation. Simply how I think is my problem. SHIT, I stand before you today over 26 years away from a drink, and I have an alcoholic mind. I am recovered from a seemingly hopeless condition of mind and body. But make no mistake, I have alcoholism. My dad had alcoholism. He died with alcoholism. But he died 15 years sober, and he did not die because of alcoholism. I'll die with alcoholism. I will not die because of alcoholism. If I continue to do today what I've been doing for the last several years, and that's following the directions of the program of recovery. The longer I am in Alcoholics Anonymous, the more clear it becomes that I really don't know very much. I seem to know less and less with each passing year. But I'm absolutely assured of this, and that is I am here tonight and sober tonight because somebody prayed. A lot of somebody's prayed. My wife prayed. Our children prayed. My mom prayed. She doesn't think I'm alcoholic. She just thought I was crazy. Please, God, send somebody to help my boy. Somebody prayed. That's the only explanation of my being here tonight. And if you're an alcoholic and you're here tonight, you're here because somebody prayed. A lot of somebody's prayed. Now, you may not believe that, and you may not like that. And quite frankly, I don't care, because it just happens to be true. That's how we get here, is through the power of prayer. Now, rather than argue about that, here's something I think we can all embrace. without any argument, and that is that the people who are in this room right here, right now, have never been assembled together in the history of the world, and we are never, ever going to be assembled together again. And our book says there is one that has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Right here, right now. There's somebody in this room tonight who had absolutely no intention of attending this meeting. And yet here you are. You are not here by accident. There are others here this evening who have been sent here to hear something. I don't know what you were sent here to hear. I don't know if it was to be heard by you for you, or if it's something you're to take back to your home group, or to take back to a sponsee that you have, or maybe it's that new sponsee that you don't have yet but's coming along next week. See, God sees ahead, and he prepares the way. I have a pamphlet here. It's called A Member's Eye View of Alcoholics Anonymous. I hope all of you have, that you all possess a copy of this pamphlet. I hope everybody in this room has read this pamphlet. But somehow, I don't think that's true. I happen to think that this is the finest piece of literature in Alcoholics Anonymous outside of the big book that we have. Now, that's my opinion. If you have not read this pamphlet, you don't have an opinion. I'd like to read the last part of this pamphlet. Tomorrow, Sunday, in the churches of many of us, there will be read that portion of the Gospel of Matthew which recounts the time when John the Baptist was languishing in the prison of Herod, and hearing of the works of his cousin Jesus, he sent two of his disciples to say to him, "Art thou he who is to come, or shall we look for another?" And Christ did as he so often did. He did not answer them directly, but wanted John to decide for himself. And so he said to the disciples, "Go and report to John what you have heard and what you have seen. The blind see, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead rise, the poor have the gospel preached to them." Back in my childhood catechism days, I was taught that the poor, in this instance, did not mean only the poor in a material sense, but also meant the poor in spirit. Those who burned with an inner hunger and an inner thirst. And that the word gospel meant, quite literally, the good news. A number of years ago, two men, Ken and Bob, working singularly and together, maneuvered me into Alcoholics Anonymous. Tonight, if they were here and they were to ask me, "Tell us, Jack, what did you find?" I would have to say to them what I now say to you. I can tell you only what I have heard and seen. It seems the blind do see, the lame do walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead rise. And over again, in the middle of the longest day or the darkest night, the poor in spirit have the good news told to them. God grant that it may always be so. My name is Jack. I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is April 7th, 1982. Thank you for letting me share.